Y'all ready to hang?
He's made his mark twice in basketball, as a player and a broadcaster. And now he's got a new role as well. After scoring a record 51 points and grabbing 24 rebounds in the state championship game and being named Mr. Basketball in the state of Ohio in 1979, he starred for three seasons at Ohio State. He was named the Big Ten Conference's Most Valuable Player in 1982, at which point he left college a year early to enter the NBA draft. He wound up the eighth pick in the 82 draft by the Pacers and had the best rookie season in franchise history when he averaged 20.1 points and 10.6 rebounds. His knee gave out after three seasons, though, forcing him into a career that he hadn't even planned for, broadcasting. He rose to the top of that profession as well, and he's now the lead college basketball analyst for CBS Sports, calling championship games at the NCAA tournament. His colorful, intelligent style has won him fans all over the country and kept him at the top of an ultra-competitive profession. He also called Pacers games for several years, but he gave that up for a front office job, Vice President of Player Relations. This conversation took place in 2010, right before he called the Final Four in Indianapolis, and well before he assumed his current role with the Pacers. There's a lot of ground to cover, so let's go. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Clark Kellogg.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Today on One-on-One, we are honored to have a notable figure from Indiana basketball, Clark Kellogg, known mostly in Ohio, but he did play for the Indiana Pacers and is known to Indiana fans certainly as a college basketball analyst and also a part-time Pacer analyst. Well, let's start, Clark, at the beginnings of your basketball career, and we'll get up to your broadcasting roles. From my perception, you were a blue-chip player from the very beginning. You were Ohio's Mr. Basketball. You scored 51 points in the state championship game. When did you start playing basketball seriously, and when did you start thinking that this is what you wanted to pursue?
Well, I was exposed to sports at an early age, Mark. I'm the oldest of five kids. My dad was a standout three-sport athlete growing up in Cleveland. Went to East High School there in Cleveland. Spent a little time in college, but joined the Cleveland Police Department in 1965. And spent 42 years with the police department, so never really went beyond maybe a semester or two in college as an athlete. But as I grew up in Cleveland, as I began to pursue sports, it became apparent to me my dad was pretty good in both football, basketball, and even track. But I started being serious about sports probably when I was 8 or 9 years old. My dad exposed me to football as part of his job as a Cleveland policeman. He and my uncle, who was also a Cleveland policeman, would work the Cleveland Browns football games in the dog pound. It wasn't the dog pound then, but in the bleachers behind the goalposts. And I was a diehard Browns fan growing up, and football was initially my first love. I mean, when I was 7, 8 years old, I loved going out there kicking the ball, punting it, throwing it, and would play pickup football with my neighborhood buddies. And it wasn't until I was probably about 10 that basketball really grabbed me. Okay. My dad gave me my first backyard hoop when we moved into a house in East Cleveland. This is 1969. I hadn't turned 8 years old yet. I was born in 61, summer of 61. And we moved into a new house, and he found a peach basket.
A peach basket?
Yeah. How ironic is that?
Yeah.
Cut the bottom out of it and nailed it up to a fairly thick and flat tree before he was able to get me an official goal. And
yeah,
I started throwing the ball up and dribbling and shooting it and started watching games on TV. And by the time I got to be 9, 10 years old, basketball had become my passion. That's the game that I enjoyed most. I kind of gave up football and started really zeroing in on round ball.
That's funny because Bobby Plump told me he played on a peach basket growing up in Milan.
Is that
Johnny Wooden shot at, I think it was an apple basket or whatever in the barn in Martinsville. So not everybody has a glass backboard in their backyard.
No, but you know what? Not long after that, though, my dad was able to get me a terrific basketball goal from some rec center or high school that was being demolished. It was one of those half-moon shapes.
Mm-hmm.
going back to the 60s, and it was thick and sturdy. It was high quality, and that thing lasted forever, even in the elements in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, it was the place to be if you couldn't get to the playground. Hang out at the Kellogg's because they had an official basketball goal hanging on the garage there.
This is in the driveway.
Oh, yeah, it was in the driveway. Actually, yeah. There was part of the driveway was cement, and the other part was dirt initially. So we needed it to be warm and dry so we could have a half court. And then ultimately, my dad ended up cementing that dirt part. So we could actually have, we could have a real even surface over the. I can't imagine it was more than maybe 8 yards by 6 yards or 8 yards by 10 yards, but it was enough to get some good games going.
So when you're out there, say shooting around by yourself, are you imagining yourself to be somebody in particular?
Well, my guy,
daydreaming of something?
My man. As I got into basketball and found out about him, he was at UCLA at the time, Lou Alcindor.
Oh yeah.
The most graceful big guy I'd ever seen as a youngster. And as I started to read about him, I saw how serious he was as a student and a scholar. And his grace and productivity as a collegian made me a huge fan. So that was about the time I started playing, late 60s.
Yeah.
And UCLA was one of the few teams that was televised at that time throughout the country. So I got a chance and really became a big-time fan of Lou Alcindor's. My numbers in high school were 33, and even at Ohio State, and it was in part because that was the number that he wore. So he was my man.
Did you play against your dad a lot?
I did. My dad would get out there when he'd get home from work sometimes. He'd see all the other kids in the neighborhood, and on occasion – he would get out there and play with us and bounce us around. He's about 6'4 and 230, 235 pounds at the time. And he was tough to deal with, a left-hander that could shoot it. Didn't handle it that great, and that's one of the reasons that I think I became a really good ball handler for my size, is because he really emphasized that to me as I started to show real serious interest. He said, if anything, make sure you can handle that ball. Because at that time, most big guys were rebounders and scorers inside. And he said, if you can handle that ball and continue to be able to take care of it and go places with it, then you've got a chance to be a pretty good player, especially if you grow to be as tall as we think you might.
Did he beat on you out there on the court?
Yeah, he did. He did. He wouldn't let me get the best of him until I was actually able to do it. He would keep me down, whether it was on the basketball court or even on the ping pong table. He would not. He sent me upstairs crying once or twice because I thought I could handle him and I couldn't. But by the time I got to be 15 or 16, I was starting to give him a little bit of run for his money. Age on his part was working against him, and obviously me developing was working for me.
Well, like we said, you are Mr. Basketball in 1979 in Ohio, still regarded as one of the best players ever to come out of Cleveland. And you scored 51 points in that state championship game, but you lost, right, to the Columbus team?
Columbus East, actually.
Does that game still stick with you?
Oh, yeah. You know the losses do, Mark. You've been around a lot of athletes and basketball players in particular and coaches, and it's amazing what you recall. And you recall quite a few of the good moments, but you recall as much the regrets or the losses or the things you did that you aren't quite as proud of or that you wish you would have done differently. And clearly that's one that sticks out for me. I never was able to win a championship in any level. I mean, I got to the Big Ten championship game two of my 3 years at Ohio State. Played IU in 1980.
I want to talk about that game later,
too.
That's an all-time classic.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. It's great to be part of that. The only thing that I wish I could change is the result.
Yeah.
Because we would have won an outright Big Ten championship. And then the same thing happened my junior year at Ohio State. We were playing Minnesota for a chance to share it and lost to Trent Tucker and Randy Brewer and those guys. And then, obviously, in the state championship game, we had a terrific high school team and thought we were in a position to win it and ended up losing to a very deserving Columbus East team that featured Granville Waiters, that ended up being a roommate of mine in college at Ohio State for the 3 years I was there, and then became a teammate here with the Indiana Pacers in the early 80s as well.
Coming out of high school, were you a lock for Ohio State, or did you seriously consider someplace else?
You know, at that time, Mark, you could visit six schools on the expense of the schools, and I only took four official visits. I was pretty serious about trying to be diligent and yet wise and honest with schools. I was recruited by everybody. It was one of the great high school classes of all time.
And I
know you've looked at it historically. I mean, there were some terrific players, but I only visited Ohio State, Michigan, Notre Dame, and Kentucky. I mean, not sliced liver in terms of college basketball. Those were all high power, high-profile programs and schools and reasonably close to where I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
So you picked Ohio State because, what, it was the in-state school, basically?
You know, a combination of factors, Mark. I really enjoyed Johnny Orr, who was the head coach at Michigan at that time, and there were some in my family that really had developed allegiance to Michigan. Nothing real personal, but just from a distance had kind of become enamored with Michigan and the reputation of the school academically. Proximity to Cleveland was good, much like it is to Ohio State. Ohio State is, but it ultimately came down to a couple of factors. One, I knew I wanted to stay reasonably close to home. Those four schools were all within a drive, reasonable drive from Cleveland. The other thing was the Buckeye Nation. It wasn't deemed that at that time, but the alumni base and the passion that people around the state of Ohio and even around the country had for Ohio State University and the makeup of the team at the time. Herb Williams was a center, a longtime NBA pro, dear friend, and now an assistant coach with the Knicks, former Pacer as well. Calvin Ranji had a promising but short NBA career, was a starting guard, was a junior. Then there was Carter Scott, an outstanding player from Barberton, Ohio. Jim Smith was from Cleveland. And they looked most like the team that needed a forward that could do what I could do, could shoot and handle the ball and rebound. And I just thought it would be a good fit on the court. And I felt like it would be a really good fit off the court, as best as one can think when you're 17, 18 years old. Everybody was telling me about the value of being an Ohio State kid with an Ohio State degree playing sports. And boy, has that come to be true in terms of how it's helped me in my personal and professional life.
Kellogg leaves Ohio State a year early to enter the NBA draft, but not before being named the Big Ten MVP and playing in one of the most memorable games in league history at IU when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with Clark Kellogg. He entered the NBA draft in 1982 and was chosen by the Pacers with the 8th pick. And for three seasons, he was a really good player on some really bad teams. But before that, he played in a classic Big Ten game at IU. Well, you are the Big Ten MVP in 1982. Mm-hmm. You lead Ohio State in scoring and rebounding as a sophomore and junior. But that game in 1980 when you were a freshman, you know, I covered that game down in Bloomington, the last game of the season. Yep, yep. I think something like 8 of the 10 starters in that game played in the NBA. Yeah, you're talking on IU, Isaiah, I think Whitman, Tolbert.
Woodson,
that's right.
Yeah, Landon Turner was there
Turner was on that team. And then you guys had yourself and Herb Williams and Kelvin Ranji.
Jim Smith played in the NBA for a short time with the Clippers. Yeah. Carter Scott was drafted but never played in the NBA. No, it was a phenomenal. That was in the days of one game being televised a week. Mm-hmm. The iconic threesome of Enberg and McGuire and Billy Packer were there. I know that Bloomington was abuzz. That place, Assembly Hall, was packed. And it was, as I remember it, a competitive game throughout. Mike Woodson had missed a lot of the season due to a back injury, I think, and came back and played very well. We lost the game in overtime.
76-73.
Yeah,
I just looked it
on
up.
A phantom foul
that
was called on Herb Williams. We feel like we got Homer, but it was still a great game to be part of, and that's one of the regrets. I wish we could have grabbed that one because that would have been a tremendous conference championship to win it on the road against one of the great programs in the history of college basketball.
That's a game I would love to see on TV again on, you know, the Big Ten Network or something, because that is such a classic.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, it really was.
Well,
you're drafted by the Pacers with the number 8 pick in 1982. What was the pre-draft process like then? Did you come over here and visit?
No, you know what? It was really different. There were no – at that time, if you were going to declare as an underclassman, there were no such thing. You weren't allowed to work out as you are now. You were not allowed to work out. You had to really try to, in almost a covert fashion, find out what general managers were thinking about you, because they weren't allowed to really talk to you until you had declared. And once you declared, then I went through a couple of interviews where player personnel would come to my city in Columbus, or they would fly me. I went out to Dallas to meet with the front office and coaching staff there. Rod Thorne was the general manager of the Bulls at the time, and he actually came to Columbus. And those were the only two teams that I visited with, and yet Dallas was drafting fourth, and Chicago was going to draft seventh. So because I only visited with those two teams, I thought I was going to go between four and seven. I think Indiana thought I was going to go a little higher as well from what I read afterwards. And in talking to folks, and when I was there at eight, their scouts had seen me quite a bit. I think it was Jerry Oliver at the time
who was there.
And he had come over and either seen me here on Big Ten trips or been to Columbus quite a bit. And they felt pretty strongly about my ability to be a valuable asset and drafted me. And it was a great fit. Herb was here already. Mm-hmm. Herb Williams had been here a year. So he broke me in. And it wasn't too far away from home. It was Midwest, Big Ten country. So it was really, despite the team's struggles at the time, it was really, from a personal standpoint, a pretty good opportunity and fit for me as a person and as a player.
Well, your rookie year, you might have had the best rookie season of any Pacer in franchise history. You averaged 20.1 points and 10.6 rebounds as a rookie. You're on the all-rookie team. You probably should have been rookie of the year. I think, right? I mean, what Dominique was. What,
no,
right?
No, Terry. Terry Cummings.
Oh,
was,
Terry
yeah.
Cummings.
And his numbers
right.
were a little better than mine, actually.
Were they?
Yeah. He
okay.
had missed some time during the regular season because of a heart ailment that he had that he got corrected with medication. But he was a 2010 guy that year as well. I think he was a 23-10 guy for the Clippers. So
okay.
while I thought I should have been considered strongly and would have liked to have won it, I couldn't argue with the fact that Terry was able to get the award.
Well, players averaging a double-double are rare in the Pacer franchise history, and it really wasn't until Jermaine O'Neal came along in 2001-02 season that they kind of became more standard or
yeah,
ever happened
right.
at all.
Right.
So that was really an accomplishment. Unfortunately, the Pacers won 20 games that season.
Man.
And then your second year, you averaged 19.1 points and 9.1 rebounds. Your third year, you averaged 18.6 points and 9.4 rebounds. But the Pacers won just 26 and 22 games those seasons. What do you recall of those three seasons when you're playing so well and the team is just terrible?
Well, a couple of things. One is that each year we seem to have tremendous turnover on our roster, which was an indication that we were still very much trying to build the kind of talent that could win consistently. I know my rookie year, the team was in some financial turmoil and uncertainty, and as a result, we lost a couple of veteran players, Johnny Davis. I think Lewis Orr was part of and those two guys may have had a hand in helping us be more competitive because we were just young, and while we had some decent talent, we didn't have the kind of talent that could deal with being young and still win. So we just were not in a position to be competitive on a regular basis. I mean, we were starting to build some pieces. Herb Williams was only in his second year, my rookie year. I was a rookie. Butch Carter was here, Jerry Seestein. We drafted Vern Fleming in 84, Steve Stepanovich in 83. So we started to build some pieces, and it just takes time when you're starting from the bottom. And then the financial uncertainty certainly put a harness on what the organization could do in terms of trying to acquire more experienced talent quicker.
How does an NBA player maintain his attitude, his intensity toward the game when you're on a team losing night after night after night?
And you know, when you're a young team and you have young players, it's really difficult on the one hand because there aren't veterans there to kind of show you what it means to be successful because all of us were relatively young and hadn't had much NBA success. So we were kind of learning on the fly and growing, trying to grow and win and not being able to do the winning part. So it was challenging. The other thing, though, is that as a young player, you desire to prove that you belong in this league. And so individually, you're hoping that you're playing at a level that says, I'm going to be part of this when it gets turned around. If not here, then I want to be in the league and prove that I can play. So that's a driving force when you're struggling as a team to continue to go out and try to play hard and show that you're an NBA caliber player. And that's kind of what my focus was, Mark, just trying to be the best player I could be. And then also trying to be a solid representative of the franchise in the community, because I always felt that was really important as just as a person, but certainly as a pro athlete too.
Mm-hmm. This is the time when they're drawing the curtains around the upper level of Market Square. There's probably 3,000 or 4,000 fans there. I mean, it had
on
to
a good
be,
night.
Yeah, it had to be kind of maybe not depressing, but just discouraging to be playing in that kind of atmosphere. And
You know,
it was a long way from Ohio State.
Oh, no question about it. Sold out crowds and people abuzz and being competitive in league play and so forth. Yeah, it was difficult. But the thing that kept me going was, one, I was realizing a dream. I wanted to be an NBA player, and I was proving that I was going to be a good NBA player. So the lack of fan support was challenging and difficult, but I tended to focus on the positive. I love the fans that were there. They seemed to appreciate us and would come out in decent numbers and certainly come out in larger numbers when the Lakers and Celtics would show up and a number of those fans would be wearing their those teams' jerseys. But they also had some feelings for us. And you know what? When you're out there, you have to concentrate on trying to play. And that's what I really did. I mean, it was always fun whenever we had good crowds and there weren't many of them. And even on the road, it would be tough because a lot of places just weren't drawing that strong. So it was part of not only our situation as being members of the Indiana Pacers, but there were a number of other teams in the league that were struggling with attendance as well.
Yeah, I remember you hit a game-winning shot to beat Larry Bird and the Celtics at Marcus Square, and I think it was sold out because of Bird being
coming back, without question.
A game-winning shot.
Yeah, that's a great thrill. That's one of my fond memories. The Celtics were winning championships in the early, mid-'80s, and just were stacked and always looked forward to going up against Larry and had some decent games individually, but we could rarely beat that team. They were just too good.
Yeah.
But on that one occasion, we did find a way to beat them at the buzzer and to get a shot off an offensive rebound
right
to win the game.
That's what I thought, yeah.
That was kind of fitting for me. I chased down quite a few of those missed shots.
You knew where the easy points were.
That's right.
Kellogg's NBA career ends prematurely, but he quickly finds a home in broadcasting when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Kellogg being announced by NBA Commissioner Larry O'Brien in the 1982 NBA draft and then being interviewed afterward by Eddie Doucette.
Could I have your attention, please? Indiana picks 6'7", 215-pound forward from Ohio State, Clark Kellogg.
All right, now you go to Indiana, our good friend Jack McKinney, and of course Herb Williams, who you played with over there at OSU. That ought to be helpful.
Oh, for sure. I'm glad to be with Herb, and I think we can work well together. Maybe we'll get a chance to start Indiana on the winning track.
Bobby Knight, who has made news already today, we've quoted him once before, said that Clark Kellogg is perhaps the best power forward in the country. You ready to live up to those kind of plaudits?
I sure like to try.
Well, I think that perhaps you're going to get a good opportunity. Indiana, it was said, perhaps might go to a big guard, but yet they've come away with the man they thought was the best available choice in this particular spot. A lot of people didn't think you'd be available at this far down, but here you are, and, of course, now a chance to go with the Pacers.
Right, I'm happy about it. I kind of felt I might go between 4 and 7, but that didn't happen, so I'm glad to be going 8th to Indiana.
On One-on-One, Mark Monteith here, spending this July 4th holiday with an encore presentation of my conversation with Clark Kellogg. He got his broadcasting start with the Pacers and WIBC after his playing career ended, and he rose quickly to the top of a new profession.
Well, in your fourth season, things turned south. I mean, you played 19 games that year, and then you blow out your knee. How did that happen? Do you remember the specifics?
You know what? I don't remember. I don't think it was necessarily a specific play. I do remember having some swelling after a particular game, and that was kind of the beginning of the trouble being diagnosed, which was wearing away of the cartilage on the interior part of my knee, the medial cartilage. And I had a knee surgery, and actually it was my third year, I think, that I had my first knee operation.
After your third season?
Yeah. It was before training camp of my third year.
Okay.
I had surgery but was able to come back and play 77 games that year. And then was off to a terrific start in my fourth season in terms of understanding what George Irvin wanted from me. I was a fourth-year guy and really started to grab hold of what leadership was going to be about and how important it was going to be for me to help set a tone and a foundation going forward. and it really had a good summer and a really good training camp and was off to a strong start during that season, and after the fourth or fifth game had some reoccurring swelling.
Okay.
And at that point in time, it was diagnosed that I had worn away some cartilage, had a knee surgery, and then came back for a few games and ended up only playing 19 that year. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. I worked out and tried to come back the following year. The knee was still not responding. Had one more surgery, my third in 3 years on the same knee, and only played three or four games.
Played just, four games that
and
next
that
year.
Was, and then in August of 87,
right.
realized after rehabbing and trying to do what was asked of me from a rehabilitation standpoint, and then getting back out on the court just for some pickup action during the late spring and summer, that there was no way my knee was going to be able to withstand what's required of an NBA season, and had to give it up.
So the cartilage just kind of wore away.
Yeah, it just wore away, and it was something that was not caused by any one particular injury, but it could have been hereditary. It could have been just based on how my body is in terms of biomechanics and my feet and those types of things. And it was just one of those unfortunate circumstances that led to me not being able to hold up to the rigors of NBA basketball anymore.
So if that happened today, though, would they be able to do something about it and keep you on the court?
You know what? I'm not sure. I think there have been plenty of advancements made in not only diagnosing and treating through surgery different injuries, but also the rehabilitation. I think the one thing that might have been different that could have helped me was the extensive training that's done now from the chest area to the knee area in terms of strengthening that core, the glutes, the hamstrings, the quads, that whole area, strengthening that and doing some corrective rehabilitation and strengthening in terms of trying to modify whatever biomechanics might have predisposed me to wearing out the inside of that knee. I think that would have been helpful. And even after one of my surgeries, which was all three were arthroscopic, now when you have a wearing away of cartilage, it's called the microfracture mm-hmm. surgery now.
Okay.
And the difference really is not just in what they do, but the time they give you to stay non-weight-bearing is much more extended than a 4 to 6 week period. You might see guys that go through that microfracture surgery be non-weight-bearing for 8 to 10 weeks to give that area a chance to really heal. And then the rehabilitation is a little different and a little slower to give that injury a chance. Jason Kidd has come back from it. Amari Stoudemire. Greg Oden is trying to work back from it. There have been a number of guys that have, but there have been a number of guys that haven't been able to come back. Guys in my era, Roy Henson, Jeff Rulin,
yeah.
the late Derek Smith, they were all suffering from the same type of wearing away of the cartilage and just weren't able to quite get back.
Do you remember a specific moment when you realized, I've got to retire, I cannot play anymore?
Well, after my third arthroscopy in December of 1986, the doctors didn't give me much hope about trying to come back or being able to come back. I wanted to give it every chance that I could through rehabilitation to see if, in fact, I could get back. And from December of 86, the rehabilitation into the late winter, spring, and summer, and then ultimately getting out on the court and still having the same reoccurring swelling problems gave me a pretty clear indication that it was going to be time to hang it mm-hmm. up. Yeah,
you played four games in 86-87. That's when Chuck Person's here as a rookie.
That's right. That's
and Jack Ramsey's the coach. Yep. It's the beginning of a new era.
Yep.
And you're finishing up. You know, you can't go anymore. Do you remember your last game and the moment when you had to decide to retire? And
you know,
all
that? I can't really remember that last game.
I remember a press conference downtown where you announced it.
Oh, yeah, that was in August. That was late. That was in August of 1987. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was
that's
in
right.
August. Yeah, it was in August. It was actually right after they had drafted Chuck. And then it was because Chuck was drafted in
86.
86, that's right. That's
right. Right after they drafted Rick Smith.
Yeah.
No. Reggie.
Right.
Right. So you were almost a teammate of Reggie's.
No, Reggie came in 87, I think.
Right. You said August of 87.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's right. That was right after they had drafted Reggie.
Yeah.
And never had a chance to play with him, but was fortunate enough to be courtside as a broadcaster for his illustrious 18-year career here. But, at that point, in August of 87, I had been out trying to play some pickup games and just was not having the kind of success with my knee responding that I, and after the doctors had said what they said, and I'm 25, 26 years old, I just felt like it was time to move to the next chapter mm-hmm. because I didn't want to be in a position where I did extended damage that would really affect my quality of life going forward, especially if I wasn't going to be able to play basketball.
Yeah.
So why take that risk? So it was a tough decision, but it was the only decision, really.
How difficult was the adjustment to the so-called real world? Was there a mourning period for you, to speak?
And oh, yeah, that was a terrific mourning period. I'm a Christian. I gave my life to Christ back in 1986, November of 86. I retired in August of 87. And I was pretty confident as I was growing in my faith, thanks to a number of people that came alongside me, that my future was unsure, but I knew that God held my future. And it was a really good opportunity when Donnie Walsh gave me a chance to stay involved with the organization as a broadcaster on the radio network.
Oh, that was his call, huh?
That was, yeah. He actually, we didn't know at the time when I retired, but he made it clear that he'd like me to stay involved in some capacity, and it was just a matter of finding out what I thought I might like to do and what might help the franchise or serve the franchise in a positive manner in the broadcasting. Sounded good. It sounded like a good way to stay in the game. I've always enjoyed communicating and interacting with the media. I've always enjoyed trying to be a student of the game. So it seemed like a good opportunity to just not go cold turkey from basketball. Initially, I thought about just going on an entrepreneurial bent because I've always been interested in business. But when I thought about it, I felt like staying involved in some capacity would be good, and we'll see what happens with it.
Yeah. Had you not even thought about broadcasting until then? When you were playing, did you think
someday? No, my focus was playing and hopefully being able to play 10, 12 years, and during that time discovering an area of business that I might want to get into, whether it was financial services or being an investor or being a franchisee. But I wanted to be involved in business in some capacity and was hoping to be able to set myself up that way through playing basketball for 10 or 12 years. Yeah. When that didn't happen, I still had a lot of basketball in me. I knew I didn't want to get into coaching at that time. And to be able to talk about the game and perhaps carve out another career for myself started to sound appealing once I got behind the microphone that year, 87, 88.
And you were doing the radio broadcast.
Right.
This is before Mark Boyle, right?
Yeah, it was Mike Inglis, okay, who now does the Miami Heat games. Yeah, yeah, but Mike Inglis had been hired really late in the process. Mm-hmm. I think he got hired maybe in late August or September. So the Pacers felt I could help him. He was from Canada and had a great voice and a great way about him, but I knew the league probably better than he did, having just played in it. So it seemed like a good fit and a good opportunity for a win-win for both the Pacers and for me. So I stumbled through my first year or two.
Yeah. I was going to ask how it went.
Oh, yeah.
Because they just kind of threw you out there. You didn't have any broadcasting courses
or had no broadcasting training. The only communication experience I had was being on the other side of it, interacting with the media from my days as a high school player.
Mm-hmm.
I was always involved in dealing with the media and then through college and certainly with the Pacers. And my mom had admonished me. We lost my mom in 1994. But as I was sharing this and progressing along this path of being a standout basketball player, she would admonish me constantly about being able to handle interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, you better be able to put together a sentence, and you better be able to answer questions coherently. And she was probably more proud of how I handled the interviews that came with me being an outstanding basketball player than me being an outstanding basketball player. And that really was quite motivating for me to see and know that she took great pride in me being able to communicate effectively and to speak in a way that would make her proud. And that was really part of what made me so conscientious about it as I was going through high school and college and the NBA. And while I didn't have formal training, that was some training.
Yeah.
And it actually laid the groundwork for me to get to where I've gotten to today.
Any surviving tapes of your initial
broadcasting? Oh, I've got a few of them around. I don't revisit them too much. I put my foot in my mouth enough doing what I do currently, and I do try to watch as many of my current games as possible just to stay sharp and to try to get better. But I haven't dug into the archives for some of my...
Well, send some over. I want to play them as part of the show.
Well, I imagine WIBC would have some of my radio updates.
Well, I was going to ask because you also were doing morning radio.
Yeah, I was doing some updates. Yeah, I was doing a little morning radio.
For IBC.
Yeah, I was doing that for IBC. I was doing the pregame interview with the opposing coach in addition to doing the game analysis during the game on radio with Mike Inglis. And I did work one year with Mark Boyle. I just did the home games when he took over for Mike Inglis. Mike and I did pretty much all of the games together my first year. Then year two, I did primarily the home games with Mark Boyle. And then the TV started to come into fruition at the collegiate level, and my schedule started to increase. And then we moved back to Ohio, and I ended up moving to TV doing primarily road games for the Pacers at that time, yeah.
But you were coming into the IBC and just reading a sports update in the morning?
Yeah, exactly.
How did that go?
Oh, it went well. I mean, I know from people that have heard me and seen me journey from that point to now that I was not very good.
Yeah.
I knew that.
You can't be good at the beginning.
No, at the beginning, exactly. And the fact that people would come up to me and say, "My, you've really gotten better," really was in their minds maybe a backhanded comment, but for me, it was a sign of progress because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get better, and I was willing to work at it. And like you said, you can't be good when you first start at something new, but over time, you hope to get better, and that's been the case.
Well, I tried. I checked with people here at the radio station and the Pacers to try to get some old audio tapes of Clark's broadcast beginnings, hoping to embarrass him and entertain us. But there were none to be found. We'll resume the conversation with Clark when the one-on-one continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with a special encore edition of my 2010 conversation with former Pacers star and current Pacers front office member, Clark Kellogg. He just told us about the beginnings of his broadcasting career. Now let's get up to date on his current broadcasting career, learn why he went back to get his college degree, and find out about those hoop dreams. You've always had a certain flair as a color analyst. Expressions like if somebody grabs a rebound, you say squeeze the orange, for example. I mean, are these things you sit around and try to think up, or do they just come to you at the time?
My approach has always been to try to use basketball jargon as I hear it from current players because it changes over time. There are certain phrases that are universal to describing basketball. Then there are phrases that come and go based on time period. As far as describing situations and some of the trash talking that you can use in analyzing games or analyzing situations. So I'm selective and judicious in that, but I try to be current with the phrases that players use to a certain degree. And then I also am very diligent about trying to use everyday situations or circumstances that are common to all of us, whether we're basketball junkies or not, that I can use in describing a basketball situation. You talked about squeeze the orange. I'll sometimes add to that, if you want fresh squeezed orange juice, you've got to squeeze the orange. Where in basketball, if you take care of it, you got a chance to get points.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to analyze that with a little flair. I'll use situations involving food, buffet style on the glass, plenty of seconds. That's second shot opportunities. But we all eat. We've all been to buffet lines. And you understand you pretty much can get as much as you want at the buffet line. So I'll use those kind of things. Eating is a universal language, much like music.
Right.
So I'll use a number of food analogies. Dessert before dinner. That's shooting too quickly. Let's go ahead and take care of our main meal. Then we can enjoy dessert. So in a basketball situation, let's make sure we get good shots and not force things too early. So I would always try to come up with different ways. And a lot of them come to me from things I read or things I'm doing. I'll do stuff around the house. And I'll say, man, that could fit in a basketball analogy. Just something common. Dealing with the computer, screensaver mode, spyware. Everybody knows about that. Is there a way to put that into a basketball analogy? So I do think about them, but I try not to force them.
Mm-hmm. We talked about you leaving Ohio State after your junior season. You went back and got your degree in what year?
I graduated in 1996, Mark. I was able to take a class. Actually, I took two classes. Rosie and I got married in 1983 at the end of my first year with the Indiana Pacers. And I went back to Columbus at that time. We had an apartment in Columbus and went back and took two classes at Ohio State that summer. And that was the beginning of keeping me on track to finish up and get my degree. I ended up taking some classes at IUPUI here in Indianapolis, and then ultimately had to take my last two classes at Ohio State in order to get my degree from there, which is what I wanted to do. So I ended up graduating from 1996. Neat story. I had a Pacers game in Los Angeles on whatever the day was before graduation and flew the red eye to get back to participate in the graduation at St. John Arena.
Oh, okay.
And I was exhausted, but the adrenaline was more than enough to keep me awake and able to enjoy receiving my diploma from Ohio State.
Yeah, I remember talking to you on a Pacer road trip in a hotel restaurant somewhere on the West Coast about this, and that was 96, huh?
Yeah, it was 1996.
I thought it was later.
No, it was 1996. Yeah, it's been a little while since.
You must have gotten the big ovation when they called you up for your diploma.
Yeah, they
Ohio
did.
State.
The president at that time was Gordon Gee. He went to Vanderbilt not long after that and has since come back to Ohio State, and it's one of my fond memories to have gotten my degree from a two-time president of the Ohio State University. But he did make special note that amongst the graduates was one of our outstanding former basketball players who's come back after pursuing his NBA career.
Yeah.
It was neat. It was a neat moment.
What was your degree in?
Marketing. I was a marketing major, yeah.
Why not broadcasting?
Well, if I'd have known that I would have headed this direction, I would have probably pursued it. But marketing basically was a way for me to get kind of a broad brushstroke in the world of business. That's really what drove me to marketing, because you get a little sampling of everything from a business standpoint in marketing.
I was telling someone today, one thing that always amazed me about the way you did games is that you will sit courtside during a game and eat popcorn. Now, when I eat popcorn, that stuff gets stuck in my throat, and I'm coughing and stuff. I mean, I wouldn't even be able to do
it. Well, at my core, I'm a former player and I'm a fan. And even though I'm a broadcaster, I still like to keep the element of the fan in play. Eating at the game is one of the things I like to do as a fan, even though I'm officially on duty. And popcorn happens to be one of my favorite snacks when I'm in an arena, in addition to yogurt or ice cream. And any of my former teammates or coaches or trainers will tell you that when we travel with the Pacers and we went through those airports, if there was an ice cream stand, I was there.
How long do you want to continue your broadcasting career? As long as you can, or do you have something else in mind?
I tend to look at it in 3 to 5 year windows. I don't see myself as a lifer, but I won't say that it won't be a long time from now. But I can envision myself going in a different direction sooner rather than later.
Mm.
Teaching or being involved in ministry with young folks could be an avenue that God might call me to. So I'm open, but I love what I'm doing right now. And for the near future, which is, again, 3 to 5 years for me, I anticipate doing some level of commentary.
Okay, I've got a theme question I've asked everybody.
Okay.
When you're sleeping at night, do you have dreams that you're playing again, that you're playing basketball?
It's funny you ask that. I've had a number of times over the last 20 years or so where I've had vivid dream of being out there, making it happen again, scoring, rebounding, competing. And I've had a number of those dreams. And again, over 20 years, I've probably had 10 or 15 of those dreams. And it's scary. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. But the reality is, when I wake up, I know I can't do that anymore. But it is fun to go back in dreamland and feel like you were out there doing it.
Are you in a high school game, a college game, or an NBA game? Or
it's typically been it's typically been pro. It's typically been pro, as I remember. And sometimes dreams are a little gray and fuzzy,
sure,
obviously. But as I've remember the dreams, they have been at the pro level. I kind of exhausted my high school and pro college stuff. The pro is where I was short-circuited.
Unfinished business.
Yes. So I think for the most part, again, as I recall, my basketball dreams have been of me playing in the pro game.
Yeah, interesting. Are you playing with specific people or against people or anything
I can't specifically recall. It's just the idea of being out there on the floor and making moves that I know I can't make anymore. But they've actually a couple of those times it's awakened me, because you start feeling like you're moving and doing that stuff, and it's awakened me, and I'm like, oh my goodness.
I get interesting answers to that, because Larry Bird says he will have dreams occasionally where he's playing and plays terribly.
Really?
He does. Usually does not play well in his dreams.
I don't know how I play. It's just nice to think about being out there again in my dreams.
Freddie Lewis, original Pacer from the ABA days, has dreams that he's playing like with LeBron James.
Really?
This kind of thing.
And, wow, that's interesting.
You know, some guys dream that they, like Tamika Catching said, she dreams and plays well.
Yeah.
And, some people play terribly. You know, it's really funny how that goes.
That is.
And
that's
there's
great,
no
that's
rhyme or reason for it.
No, exactly. That's a great question.
One-on-One with Clark Kellogg continues in a moment. All right. Thanks to Clark Kellogg for his participation in today's one-on-one extravaganza. You know, the background music for this episode is called Hang Time by the man who was Kellogg's teammate briefly with the Pacers, Wayman Tisdale. Kellogg didn't have much hang time on the basketball court. He was a power player, and his career didn't have much hang time either. But he's had a lot of it in his careers after basketball. He survived and thrived as a broadcaster, and now is solidly entrenched in the Pacers front office as the Vice President of Player Relations. It's not an empty title. It's a real job in which Kellogg helps the players prepare for their lives after basketball and expand their current roles in the community. He's certainly set an example for him with all he's done since his career came to a premature end. It's a shame that had to happen because Kellogg was on his way to a great playing career. But he's made the most of a bad situation and proved himself as a man who could thrive in any situation. Now, stay tuned, because next hour, I'll bring you the story of one of the current Pacers, a man who in many ways is a modern-day version of Kellogg in both his style of play and his off-court maturity, David West. He's the Pacers' top priority in free agency, and in fact, by the time this show airs, he might already be re-signed. He came to the NBA via a much different route than Kellogg, but in many ways, they wound up in the same place. That's coming up as we bring you encore episodes of my one-on-one conversations with Pacers, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.